After trying it, I had rheumatic pains, and when I could not work, the summoner sent me to prison for hard labour for 21 days. For the pauper allowance, I am letting your honour knows, I got always a pint of tea, 1.5 pounds potatoes for breakfast, for dinner 3 gills of skilly, for supper 6.5 ounces of bread.
You're listening to a letter written in 1858 by John Hankerson, who was struggling with ill health, starvation, and being worked to the bone. His letter was a plea for help.
For infirm men, 7 ounces of sugar in the week and 1 ounce tea, 5 ounces of butter. This allowance we do not get. I can prove to it since Mr. Lloyd died. Paupers are used with all cruelty.
This is On the Record at the National Archives, uncovering the past through stories of everyday people. I'm Chloe Lee, a migration and citizenship researcher here at the National Archives. And in this episode of On the Record, I'm being guided through an extraordinary collection of letters by my colleague, Paul Carter. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Great to have you in the studio today. Yeah. So, Paul, honesty as the best policy, my knowledge of the Victorian poor is limited to pretty much Charles Dickens, and even that maybe the Muppets Christmas Carol. So I'm really grateful to you for spending the time today to talk to me and share your insight. Yourself and your colleagues have been working through a unique stack of letters and testimonies that we hold here at the National Archives in Kew. And this project has taken years. The records are known as the Poor Law Correspondence. Researchers have discovered that this collection offers a unique perspective on how those living in poverty felt about their circumstances and what they did to try and change them. Direct accounts from people experiencing poverty can be rare in the historical record, especially the further back you look. So to have an archive of thousands of letters written by some of the most vulnerable Victorians is really incredibly useful. These letters help us to understand their lives and reflect on where we are today. Paul, before we share another one of those letters and delve into the history in a bit more detail, can you clarify what the difference is between a person that's poor and what's called a pauper?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at this particular time in history, and we're looking at the 1830s when the new poor law comes in, the expectation was that the vast majority of our population is going to be poor. Poor was a normalised state of existence for most people living in England and Wales. And that's what we're talking about, England and Wales. Scotland is separate, Ireland is separate. They have their own legislation and their own history. So if you are in receipt of relief, and that's the big distinction, you're a pauper. So a pauper receives relief. And that had been the case under the old poor law, as well as moving into the new poor law in the 1830s. So a poor person is poor, but in the eyes of the authorities, is not destitute. And because they're not destitute, they don't receive relief. And that's the kind of distinction that we work with, and that historically administrators would have worked with.
I see. And when you say destitute, what do you mean by that? Is that someone who doesn't have shelter? Is that someone who doesn't have access to food?
Yeah, you don't have access to the requirements for life.
Got it.
So it's but interestingly though, and not an aside at all, the legislation doesn't define it. Mm. And that's why the poor law is an area of contestation. You can contest it, and paupers contest it in their letters and undoubtedly in their conversations with local officials, because it's not set out. So this is a letter dated February the 5th, 1842, so at the beginning of the Hungry Forties, and it comes from Ilkeston in Derbyshire, and it's written by a man named Thomas Henshaw.
Ilkeston, February 5th, 1842. Gentlemen, I beg leave most humbly to submit my case to you for your consideration, and pray that you will afford me that redress in my most distressing case. I am a poor man by trade, a framework knitter, and have been for a length of time nearly out of employment, and now entirely so. I have a wife and 3 children, and we have been completely destitute of food since February the 1st to the present time. Mr. Bennett refuses to allow me anything so that we may live and die in a land of plenty. Gentlemen, I submit my case to you, and hope you will afford me that assistance as speedy as possible my case needs, which will oblige. Your humble servant, Thomas Henshaw.
Okay, so here we have someone who seems to have tried to change his circumstances, but still struggling. Paul, can you tell me a bit more about the letter and this collection that it's part of?
Yeah, sure. So this is, I mean, to some degree, this is kind of a classic letter. It's an individual who is attempting to show destitution. So at the moment that they're writing it, they're not in receipt of relief. So to that degree, they're wanting to be regarded as a pauper. Because if they can be regarded as a pauper, then relief will kick in. Now, of course, in that letter, we've heard in his own words how he has done the right thing. So he's made these applications. They're destitute of food. So I've made this application locally. I've made it to a couple of people locally. And they've said no. I've been to a magistrate. And a magistrate has said, yes, you should get this. But still, I'm getting a no from the local officials. But what we can see in that letter, which is really striking from that letter, is the references to the law, references to the regulations, references to rules. And this isn't by happenstance. This is a person who's thought about, what are the words I need to say to engage the person that I'm writing that letter to in London? Mm. It's written from Derbyshire, the Nottinghamshire borders. So they set out the problems that the family are facing, set out that I've done the right thing. And what he's essentially saying to the Poor Law Commission in London is, your officers in the locality, they're the ones that aren't doing the right thing.
I see. So he's almost trying to appeal to the central kind of system for that help.
Almost as a court of last resort. You know, we've made the appeals locally and they're not following your rules. So you need to instruct them.
So it's a real kind of well-written letter, basically. So,
yes.
And you mentioned as well that he mentioned this new poor law, and his knowledge of that poor law is extensive. Can you tell me a bit more about how important that change was from the poor law you mentioned before?
Well, there's a big difference between the old poor law and the new poor law in terms of how the system is to work. There are people who are writing letters prior to the new poor law. So paupers on the old poor law would write, but they would be usually around that they're out of place. In other words, I'm living in this area, but actually it's the area over here that should be paying me. So they were those kind of letters. And they weren't particularly strident. But here we can see that this is a complaint. This is a complaining letter. And many of our letters are complaining letters. And what they're doing is they're complaining about the locality to the centre. It's in that kind of nature. And the fact that there aren't just tens of these or a couple of hundred of these or even a couple of thousands of these, but that there are many thousands of these.
So this letter is really showing the agency of people in advocating for themselves. And Britain at the moment, how wealthy is Britain at the moment?
Well, at the moment, Britain is still the workshop of the world. It's the wealthiest nation on the planet. So in that regard, it's a wealthy nation. But to quote Pat Hudson, economic professor of history, this success of the Victorian economy was accompanied by high unemployment levels, urban squalor, and harsh working and living conditions. So there's the two. And like Disraeli's two nations. There's a
real polarity in the way that people were living.
Yeah, real polarity.
And that Poor Law Amendment Act was trying to, but it wasn't trying to close that gap.
No, the understanding was that most people will remain poor. It wasn't about getting rid of people being poor. It was, how do we get on top of the welfare bill? How do we stop pauperism, not how do we stop
people being poor?
Yeah, exactly.
I see. So we've touched on how Henshaw's letter is so special. What does it mean for how we understand this period, this collection of letters, and the people that live through it?
I think what it tells us is that the poor aren't this kind of like amalgamated blob. I mean, if you look at a lot of social and economic history, and there's nothing wrong in this, you know, people put into charts, how many people are paupers, how many people perhaps were poor and in receipt of relief at any given time. You can build graphs up, but it does depersonalize that. It does depersonalize it. It's important work, so knowing the scale is important. But what this does is it tells us for those who are living in poverty and in destitution, as he's suggesting there, it tells us what did they think about the welfare on offer and what did they want to happen as a result of it. And that comes to this idea of agency.
No, I was just going to say, interrupt you there, just a thought that I had. You know, these letters are so sophisticated, and I guess maybe the assumption is that poor people, in quotation marks, wouldn't have the kind of ability to write such sophisticated letters. Can you tell us a bit more about how they got to that point?
I mean, there'll be a variety of levels of literacy and understanding, but one of the really, perhaps it shouldn't have surprised us, but maybe did, is that level of sophistication. But when you reflect back on this as a researcher, and as a historian, you start to think, well, surely if anybody needs to know the detail of the law and how it works, it is those who are looking to be in receipt of relief. You know, the poor need it to understand. And we cover this in the book on the subject, which we'll mention at the end, but we cover this in the chapter. How did they get to know what the rules are, what the regulations are? I mean, when you look back at Henshaw's letter, you see that he's been to see a magistrate, and he talks about later in the letter, but I've seen this circular, and indeed the Poor Law Commission and later iterations of the central authority, they use these circular letters to instruct all of the poor law unions across England and Wales on certain issues around the law. So he knows about this. He knows that's what they do. He knows Edwin Chadwick, who's the secretary of the Poor Law Commission. He's found these things out.
And therefore he knows that the local authorities are not keeping up their end of the bargain.
He knows that he can lever this.
I see.
Right? He can lever this.
That's great. So, kind of, if moving on now, I just want to share some music that this letter reminds me of.
Yeah.
Henshaw's letter was written in 1842, the same year as the Children's Employment Commission, which was this official investigation into the conditions of child labour in the mines. One of the child labourers who gave evidence to that commission was a 17-year-old young woman from Halifax called Patience Kershaw. Now, in her evidence, she details working for the past 6 years in hot, cramped conditions down the mine, pushing carts of coal with men who hit her if she's too slow. And her words were turned into a song in 1969 by Frank Higgins, a folk singer. And here's a clip from a beautiful version of that song, The Testimony of Patience Kershaw by The Unpanks.
It's good of you to ask me, sir, to tell you how I spend the day. Well, in a coal black tunnel, sir, a hurry course to earn my pay. The coves are full of coal, kind sir.
Oh, what a cracking song. I mean, that is that idea of looking to get the voices of ordinary people talking about what they consider their ordinary lives, but when we listen to it, it sounds quite extraordinary. And I think poor people are always in danger of losing their voice. So it's a continual kind of struggle to keep putting that in.
Makes me think about how The Unthanks saw that as a source of inspiration as well. In 1969, what was going on then that made them want to reach back in time?
Absolutely. Cracking song.
So we'll make sure we get that link to the song in the episode notes. But let's move back towards the letters. Now, we've got thousands here at the National Archives. Can you share some more examples that give me different perspectives from different people?
Yes. So I'm going to introduce three letters to you. One of them is going to be talking about children, one about disability and the difficulties that brings with it in life, and another around an elderly couple. Now, it strikes me that all of these writers know something about the law. They don't have to be explicit in laying this out, but you'll see that in there. And you can see that there's some degree of asking for help, but there's also some degree of asking for rights. And that is another feature of this collection. It's looking to persuade. Okay, So the first one is from Mary Jones in Clannan in Wales, and this is from 1854. And she talks about, I do hereby most humbly solicit the commissioner's attention to the following case. The following case. And you use that kind of phraseology, almost like a legal case. So it's my case.
So like she's standing in front of a jury almost.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a demand above and beyond, please can you help? And she's talking about two children, and these are the children of her sister, Catherine, who's deceased, and she's looking to support those children. And she spells out the difficulties that the children have a legal settlement elsewhere to where she lives, and this is getting in the way of her receiving relief. And she talks about the money that would be needed, 2 and 6 a week, to keep the children. And then she says, now, unless the commissioners will be pleased to cause the Newcastle Emblem Board of Guardians to do justice, in this case, the truth is the children and myself must starve. They have refused to pay me anything this last 2 years. And you can imagine the kind of poverty that family has been living in under the last couple of years around this. And they've got to the point now where this is not something that can continue. And what we find here, because this is a woman writing, so what we found in the collection, if we added up all of the letters and we say, well, how many women are writing? How many men are writing? It's about 20% of the letters are written by women. About 20%. And in the 19th century, that's not unusual. If there is a couple there, the men write the letters. But there are times when that doesn't happen. And it's difficult to tell from individual letters. This one might simply be it's her deceased sister, and therefore she's writing. Maybe the husband cannot write. But this is one of those letters where you can see in there, it demonstrates the way that a woman might choose to write, bearing in mind she knows who the recipients are going to be, these very important people in London that she's writing to. So very much rooted in the rhetoric of family.
Yeah.
And children and nurturing.
And I guess and shows caring. The complexity of family structures at that time as well. You might have to take on the care of two young children.
And that this is not an uncommon feature in our letters. But it's interesting that quite often when you see that, it's the agency then of the woman. It's almost like what they're saying is we know what the characteristics that you important wealthy men in London expect a woman to be like. So what I'm going to say is I'm trying to be that, but I can't without a little help. And the local officials will not provide it. And therefore I'm asking you to step in. Mm. I'm trying to be the thing that you think I should be like, but I need you to step in. And so you can see the different rhetoric supplied
used by different writers.
Yes, used by different writers.
And what about the next letter?
So the next letter concerns an individual who has a disability because of an accident in the workplace. So let's hear from them.
To the Honourable Commissioners of the National Board of Guardians on account of Joseph Smith of Bradford, Wiltshire. Now aged 62 years, and is disabled from work by an accident that he had about 5 years ago, by which he got severely ruptured, and is altogether unable to work. His wife is 64 years old. He has applied to the board for relief, and they refuse to relieve him, unless he consents to go into the union, and he humbly seeks your advice, and humbly hopes your lordships will not be offended with this, but inform him of what are the means to make use of, so as not to starve in my own parish. You will please direct your answer to me, Joseph Smith, at Droyhill, Bradford, Wiltshire.
What can we learn from this letter, Paul?
Okay, well, I mean, one of the things that we can learn is about how dangerous work would be in the 19th century. And again, this is a relatively common kind of letter where somebody, because of something that's happened in the workplace, whether it's in a factory, whether it's in a mine, but has been injured. And as a result of that injury, now cannot gain employment that will provide a wage to cover the family.
And would that be an example of someone that would be poor, that then was almost threatened with becoming a pauper, fell into pauperism because of this accident at work.
Yeah. And indeed, this is what this person is looking to become.
Yeah.
Because if I can be identified as a pauper, I will be, that's what gets me relief. But what's interesting is that he's been offered relief and he's turning it down. So if we look at this letter, he says that he's applied to the board for relief and they refuse him unless he consents to go into the union workhouse. That is the Victorian workhouse. When he talks about the union, that's what he's meaning. And he's saying, no, that's not what I want. I want relief at home. I have worked. You know, I have worked. And there's an element of deservingness, therefore.
And pride. In his letter.
And pride and dignity and all of those kind of things. And he imbues that into his letter. I am not somebody that should go into the union. I've worked all my life through no fault of my own. You know, occupational hazard of work in the mid-19th century.
I've contributed to society as well.
Yes. And again, those kind of things, we see those come up in lots of letters about, I've made my contribution, now I can't work. It's time for me to take that out.
So there is some kind of idea about how people felt about being a pauper or being destitute, and that wasn't a place, you know, that wasn't almost deserving of, you know, of relief, you know, there's some kind of distinctions there.
There are, and different groups of people would find that easier to rhetoricize in their letters than others. So you know, so the hardest still did it, but the hardest is the able-bodied male to say, well, I want dignity and I want respect and I want. But here the letter is very much framed as, you know, I'm in my 60s, I've worked all my life, I've had this occupational accident, and therefore I am worthy of the kind of respect that's offered by outdoor relief.
I see.
Yeah.
And what about this other letter then? So we've got a couple, married couple?
Yes. So this is Daniel Rush. So he's writing from Bethnal Green, so we're in East London, well, it would have been Middlesex at this particular time. And I've got a quote from this. He's writing in August 1851, and he sets his letter out, again in the context of, I've been a worker, 71 years old, and a silk weaver. But he says, I'm past labour. I'm not able now to provide. And he talks about when full employed, can earn from 4 shillings to 5 shillings a week. But trade being bad, we now earn about 3 shillings. And I have applied to the parish of St. Matthew's, Bethnal Green, and they will not relieve me without my going into the poorhouse. So a bit like the last letter.
Yeah.
And he says, we went on Tuesday the 19th, and they insisted in separating me from my wife, which I've had for 49 years, or turn us out. And sooner then we would be separated. We will perish for want. So he's saying, rather than, we've been married all this time, you know, this is our life, and what you're going to do at the end of that life, when we're in our 70s, no longer able to earn, you're going to separate us. Because one of the features of the union workhouses is that men go one way, women go the other, children elsewhere, and the split up of a family is that idea of having an institution of last resort. And they're saying, no, this is not right. And again, it's that appeal to dignity, wanting to live in my own house.
And I guess it makes me think, surely as one family unit, they would be able to, yeah, that's surprising that then they'd want to split up that family unit that would have supported each other.
It's more than that. I mean, it's from the architects of the new poor law, a good workhouse is not one that's full.
Mm.
It's one that's almost empty.
Yeah.
Because what you're looking to do is to build in these conditions and these regulations to make welfare itself abhorrent. So that's what you're witnessing
in that
letter.
To put people off.
Yeah.
Hence why people didn't want to go to the poorhouse in the first place.
Exactly.
They wanted to be taken care of.
That was the whole nature of it. So a lot of the rules and regulations around this are to put you off it. Because if you can put off 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 applicants. What do you think happens? The welfare bill goes down. So, and it's not even them refusing relief. It's offering relief of a certain nature.
With certain caveats, yeah, certain conditions.
People will say, do you know what?
And this is really a sad letter to read, isn't it? This idea of a couple that have been together for so long, then have, you know, 71 and 68 skilled labourers, then kind of having to make that choice and make that decision. And some, I imagine, would have had to do that. Yeah. They wouldn't have been able to write letters. They would have been separated at that point.
Oh, undoubtedly. And some will write from the workhouse complaining about that. That separation, we underplay that, I think, in the new poor law historiography. It must have been such a wrench. All of these familiar things around you, and the family around you, that's going to disappear when you walk in.
So, Paul, what do we know about the people that wrote these letters? What happened in the end?
Well, we know the outcome of some of these letters. We don't know the outcome of all of these letters, because sometimes the archive doesn't survive that allows you. So a couple of points that I would make here is that what I have seen in the archive is where somebody has looked for to be put on the outdoor relief lists, and when I've gone to look at those, they're on the outdoor relief list. So we can say that in terms of agency, that there are successes in this. Sometimes, though, those successes are maybe only part of what somebody has asked for. So I do recall a lady in York writing in asking whether or not the local authorities can treat her the way that they're treating her. And she talks about being thrown onto the street. And the centre write back, and they say, tell me all the details about this. Tell me all the details about this. Because one of the things that does happen that you may not think of at first is that the central authority take note of their letters. So they'll often write back. So if Chloe, if you were this lady from York writing in, you will have got a letter back saying, we can't interfere in individual cases.
Right.
And that's what the law says, the 75th section of the Poor Law Amendment Act says, that the centre can't interfere in individual cases. But then they have this little rider saying, we will write to the York Poor Law Union asking them for further information. And in this instance, 1840s, that's exactly what they do. And they find out why they wanted to kick her out. The laws change slightly on settlement, and the local authorities are asking her information about her legal settlement. And the central authorities write back to the authorities in York and say, you can't do that. That's not your jurisdiction. The poor won't want to answer questions to you about settlement, and they do not need to. And we've checked then in later censuses, and we find that she's again on the outdoor relief list. It's difficult to proportionalise that, because not everything that the poor got was what they wanted. And there's some fascinating cases where individuals have complained about the way they've been treated in the workhouse. An investigation has been set up, and the pauper's case has been thrown out. So you think,
so
okay,
it didn't always rule in their favour.
You think, oh, that's the end of that then. But no. What you then find is that 4 weeks later, the master and matron have resigned.
I see.
Now, if you're the pauper that's instigated that, you're the one who wrote that initial letter about the treatment by those members of staff towards the poor in that workhouse, you would mark that one up as a success.
I see.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's all of those different ways, as well as simply not getting anything that you wanted. So all of those are in the mix. Mm. They're all in the soup in regard to this archive.
So, Paul, the new poor law comes in, can you remind me?
1834.
So what's the period that these letters span?
So the period for our project was 1834, the beginning of the new poor law, to around about 1900, because the new poor law changes in nature at that sort of period, late 1890s. There's a big change, and we thought we need to mark that within
so
the
that
project.
Really is a long time. Are there any changes in how the letters are written? Because we've heard a lot from individuals.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, one of the things, and when we had meetings, when we set the project up, this was not something we were thinking of looking for. But one of the things that we see is this collectivization around petitioning and letter writing. So from about the 1860s onwards, what you see is a new kind of petitions, sometimes advocate letters, where instead of it being an individual, like maybe a local vicar or perhaps a local philanthropic employer writing in on behalf of an individual poor person or pauper, you start to get letters being written about whole workforces who've been maybe thrown on the unemployment list. And I've got a couple of examples here of kind of collective. So this is from a group of Lancashire operatives, and this is how they describe themselves. They appeal to the Poor Law Board, and they state, "We are specially deputed by a body of 1,600 men of the unemployed Lancashire operatives now attending the school in Jersey Street, Manchester, to respectfully lay before you that which they consider to be a grievance." So again, not an appeal to charity. This is a grievance that we have, and we think you are the right person to deal with this.
And that language is important.
And that language is important, and it's a step change. And also, because what this isn't, is this isn't a trade union.
Okay.
They've been deputed at that time. We're in 1863. Importantly, over in America, we've got the Civil War, there's no raw cotton coming in, you've got mass unemployment now in the Northwest. So that's the context of this. Of
that's
this
helpful.
Letter.
That's the unemployment.
Yes.
Some of the root of unemployment.
And, that again is interesting. They don't describe themselves as paupers. They are the unemployed Lancashire operatives. So they've started to say a little bit different in terms of language, a little bit different, not very differential. Mm. They set out a whole host of grievances. What it strikes me as is kind of proto-trade union. It's not a continuously existing body. It's there because something's happened in 1863.
Right.
But it's that kind of thing that comes out for that with me. And they talk about themselves, they describe themselves as men whose whole lives have been one continued struggle for manly independence, who have never stooped to mortal man to ask for charity. Men who have banded together in societies to relieve their own distressed, to heal their own sick, to bury their own dead. And who have now, in this dread crisis to which the history of the country has no parallel, that's the cotton famine that they're talking about, we've already parted with our hard-earned savings that they jealously hoarded for old age or sickness. They've sold clothing, they've pulled down their household goods. To the last moment when our pride of independence must give way and we must perforce ask for assistance or see our wives and children starve before our eyes.
I mean, those words are just so compelling, and they also immediately strike me as gendered.
Yeah.
Right, this kind of, what do they call it, manly...
Independence.
Independence, again, wanting to take care of their families, not wanting to see them fall into ruin.
And again, that rhetoric of manly independence, as opposed to the looked at that the lady had written, they're trying to say, so what would the recipient of this letter want me to be?
What are they going to respond to?
Yeah, what are they going to identify? You know, the notion, Steve King from Nottingham Trent, who works on this, he's done a lot of stuff on the Old Pole as well, and he talked about the shared register. So what the people here are looking at is have a shared register with the recipient.
I see.
You know, this is what you expect us to be like. We're trying to be like that. It's not working. You now have to intervene. You now have to intervene. And one of the big grievances they're looking for is, well, you know, if we're being told we've got to, you know, we've got to be in the workhouse, we've got to be in this institution, how do we find work? How do we find work in a situation like that? And they say, you know, the boon we ask for, gentlemen, is simply a day in the week to seek employment, and that day not to be Saturday. Is the request unreasonable? You know, they're really forcing the and I want an answer to this. And it's really interesting to see. And what they've not done here is like lots and lots of individual letters about themselves and their own families.
Well, no, we're not getting 1,600 letters, are we?
No.
You're getting one.
You're getting one, but from those 1,600 people. I mean, the next two letters really show that shift towards collectivisation in terms of how poor people talk to the central authority about welfare. So the first one is a letter from Thomas Leonard, who was a member of the able-bodied ward, a pauper in the Birmingham workhouse. And he writes to complain about the death of a man called Henry Fisher, who everybody in the workhouse could see was a sick man, but was actually treated as an able-bodied man and sent to work accordingly in the body of the workhouse. He dies, tragically he dies, and Hugh Thomas Leonard sends a letter in to the local government board complaining about the treatment. Now, the thing is that this individual case now gets picked up by several trade unions, national trade union bodies. And we have a letter from the National Society of Amalgamated Brass Workers saying that the secretary there is saying, I'm directed by this society to forward a copy of the following resolution passed unanimously, and that the local government board be respectfully requested to institute an independent inquiry into all of the charges made against the Birmingham workhouse in regard to his death.
I see. So that letter's like the catalyst for this other letter that comes.
Yes. Through. Yes. It starts with the agency of the individual pauper, but it's like throwing a pebble into the pond. You've now got all of these ripples now. So now you've got trade unions getting involved. We have letters from the Independent Labour Party and the early workers' labour parties. So you can see how, when we look forward to the 20th century and then say, so how is it that trade unions have got involved in health, safety, welfare, all of those things? This has a massively long tail to it. And we can see it.
At the end of the 19th century.
We see it at the end of the 19th century.
With these
letters.
And
we see it in these letters. And it's absolutely amazing.
It's so interesting. Unfortunately, that's just where we're going to have to leave this episode. But before we finish, Paul, if listeners want to discover more of these texts and find out all about them and the people that wrote them, where can they go?
Okay, there's a couple of places that people could go. The first thing you can do is you can go to Mr. Google, and if you put in there the National Archives and Workhouse Voices, and you can also put in the National Archives and Voices of the Victorian Poor, and both of those will take you to sites where you can get hold of full transcripts of these letters. The second one, there are thousands up there that we've put on there. You can, of course, get the book in their own right, with a W, in their own right, Contesting the New Poor Law, 1834 to 1900. Cracking book, apparently. And of course, visitors here at Kew, because one of the things that you should bear in mind, we sampled this to get thousands and thousands of letters. There are thousands more, and nobody's looked at them.
And you could be one of the
and
first
you
if you come and visit us here at the archive. I mean, they're an extraordinary insight into the lives of working class people in the Victorian age, and can tell us so much about where we are now too, as well. Thanks for finding them, all your work with the project, and sharing them with us and with the world.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to On the Record from the National Archives. To find out more about the National Archives, follow the link from the episode description in your podcast listening app. Visit nationalarchives.gov.uk to subscribe to On the Record at the National Archives so you don't miss new episodes, which are released throughout the year. Listeners, we need your help to make this podcast better. We need to know a bit more about you and what themes you're interested in. You can share this information with us by visiting smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. That's smartsurvey.co.uk/on the record. We'll include that link in the episode description and on our website. You can also share your feedback or suggestions for future series by emailing us at ontherecord@nationalarchives.gov.uk. Finally, thank you to all our experts who contributed to this episode. The readers were Andrew Ashmore and Tash Walker. The song we included was The Testimony of Patience Kershaw by The Unthanks. Thanks to Annie Reid, Katie Spicer, and The Unthanks. This episode was written, edited, and produced by Tash Walker and Adam Smith of Aunt Nell for the National Archives. This podcast from the National Archives is Crown copyright. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government License. You'll hear from us soon.